mind is literally nothing. It makes no sense to use the word because it doesn't specify anything. If a descriptive term excludes nothing, it means nothing. I mean, like I say, famous example, the absolute is green. That's a good example of a nonsense statement, probably, because what does that exclude? I mean, suppose you were to say the absolute is not green. What could you show me to prove that I'm wrong? I wouldn't admit any kind of statement as proving that I'm wrong. I mean, how could you? Well, what are you going to go look at? You know, if you say the moon is green, well, there are tests we can use. When you say the absolute is green, well, when people say a certain firm is charging a fair price or an unfair price, I submit that most of the time people are making statements like the absolute is green, but they don't really know what they mean by a fair price or fair profit. They don't know how to spell out what this means. Sometimes, when we do think we know, it turns out that we are contradicting ourselves. So in either case, it would be best not to use the word. Now let's see. There are various ways of trying to get at this, and I want to try this morning by taking just the notion of a fair profit, because this is very much talked about, also in extremely high circles. The presidents of the United States, the last three, including the present one, have said that businessmen have a responsibility to price in such a manner as to be satisfied with a fair profit. Anything more than this, you know, leads to inflation. Well, I'm going to ask you what a fair profit is. Now, if everybody's using it, if the President of the United States uses the term, it must mean something, because... I mean, how would you recognize a fair profit, or how would you recognize an unfair profit?
Sometimes this is defined through a contract between a company and a community. For example, the natural gas company may agree to set its rate so as to provide the stockholders a 5% profit. This is the definition.
All right, you can say 5% return on investment is, by definition, a fair profit. Now, let me ask the question. Is it really? Is a 5% return on your investment a fair profit?
Well, doesn't it come down to what's acceptable and the risk involved, certainly, at some range?
All right, the risk involved. Would it be possible that one corporation could be making, say, a 15% return on its invested capital, and another corporation be making a 4% return, and both of them be making a fair profit? Now, why? Because of the risk. This is the most important function of profit. When an economist talks about profit, he does not mean, I've been using it in non-economic, I talk about profit on invested capital. The economist distinguishes between profit and interest. The interest is what you get on investment. When you put your money in a savings and loan association, they pay you 4.5%, that's interest. That's pretty guaranteed. That's a sum that's paid to you by somebody for the privilege of using your money. Really, for the privilege of using the resources that you abstained from using by saving and then making your savings available. And this is pretty much a guaranteed thing, an interest return. Now, if you get more than that, if you start getting 7, 8, 9% on your funds invested, you're getting interest plus some profit. And what is the profit? Well, why would you? How could you get 9% on your money? If you think about it for a moment, it's obvious you can only get it through taking a risk. You can't earn 9% on your savings unless you are willing to take a chance. You can purchase a piece of rental property and, if you're lucky, make 9%, and if you're unlucky, lose your shirt. in order to persuade you to take the chance of losing your shirt, there has to be, now notice, not the profit, but the possibility of profit. It is the hope of profit that causes people to take risks. These hopes are frequently frustrated. Look at the number of business firms that fail every year. The average life of a new business is 6 months. That's an arithmetic mean. The median firm goes out of business in 2 years with a tremendous loss to somebody, usually. Now, of course, most of these are very small businesses, gas stations, restaurants. You ever notice you live in a town, watch a restaurant pops up and then it closes and then somebody else takes it over. And going into business is a pretty risky thing. Is it very risky for a public utility? You were mentioning public utilities. It's pretty much cut and dry there. So what do you think a fair profit would be for a public utility? If there is no risk, or almost no risk, should they get anything beyond interest? No, I don't think so either. If there is really no risk, now there's always an element of risk, but the risk for a public utility is very nominal. Hence, there seems to be no functional reason for allowing a public utility a return above the interest rate which prevails. Well, now let's try another case where fair profit is frequently talked about. The one group in this country which uses the word fair more than any other is the National Association of Retail Druggists. Are there any druggists here? I'm very leery of this. I once took an editorial out of a local newspaper and read it to my students as an example of abominable economic reasoning, how people were refusing to allow fact and logic to control their argument. But we're just, whenever they had no case, they would resort to empty rhetoric. That's using it sort of as an introduction to an economics course. And when I finished, I said, I hope none of you own stock in this newspaper. And one kid raised his hand. He said, my father wrote that editorial. Then he apologized to me afterwards for embarrassing me. He's nice. Nice kid. Got a D. But the National Association of Retail Druggists lobbies incessantly, has been doing so for 30, 40 years now, for what they call fair trade laws and fair practices acts. And now, a fair trade law is really a law designed to invoke the aid of government in minimum price fixing. A fair trade law, more accurately a resale price maintenance law, is a law which permits a manufacturer to set the minimum price at which his product may be sold at retail. Now, the manufacturer seldom has as much interest in this as does the retailer. Take electrical appliances, for example. These are heavily fair traded. The little appliance dealers who handle these things are not interested in competition. They want a guaranteed profit on each item that they sell. And now the trouble is this, you know. Say you got a toaster. The appliance dealer pays $18 to the manufacturer for it. The manufacturer's suggested retail price is $27. Well, he'd like to sell it for $27 and make $9 every time he sells a toaster. The trouble is, if there are a number of appliance dealers in town or in the area, some guy's going to say, you know, I'm not selling many toasters. I think I could sell more if I slashed the price. And so he strikes out the $27 and puts down below $23.99. And if he advertises, and this fact becomes generally known, the business starts going to him, and then the other appliance dealers have no choice but to retaliate. And price competition breaks out. And pretty soon, you wind up selling just as many toasters as before, but instead of making $9 per toaster, you're only making a couple of dollars per toaster. And that gets you irritated. And then the retail druggists or the appliance dealers, the little businessmen, the little merchants say, that's not fair. We are not making a fair profit. And we've got to do something about it. Now, what can they do? It is rare indeed that they are successful in doing anything about it without dragging in the government. It's a very interesting thing to reflect upon. Businessmen like to say, we believe in keeping the government out of business. This is nonsense. They do not. Businessmen are among the keenest advocates of government intervention. But what they want is government intervention in favor of minimum prices. They don't want government intervention in favor of minimum wages. You understand why, of course. I mean, God gave the country to the businessmen, not to the labor unions or such foreigners, agitators, and all that. It's very strange. I find it puzzling how businessmen cannot see this. Guys who will condemn the minimum wage law as an unwarranted interference with the laws of supply and demand and more government meddling that's leading us down the path toward the welfare state. They see absolutely nothing wrong with minimum price fixing. This minimum price fixing, you see, is designed to prevent scandalous outbreaks of ruthless practice. I got into a discussion with some liquor dealers. Indiana has an interesting law. I believe the figures now are 13% and 25%. Every wholesaler of liquor is required to charge not less than 13% markup above the distiller's price to him. And the retailer is required to charge not less than 25% markup above the wholesaler's price to him. The result, of course, is that every bottle of booze in the state of Indiana sells at the same price within one penny. Now, I was talking about this. I said, this is seems to me this is not in the spirit of free enterprise. This is price fixing. No competition is possible. Well, you know what the answer is. You can imagine, can't you? Well, don't you realize? Do you want competition in the selling of liquor? I mean, you know, and then the idea is, as soon as you get that, you know what's going to happen. All of these packaged liquor dealers are going to be out on the corners by the grade schools persuading the kids to take a shot and get them hooked early. Now, this is the picture that they try to conjure up before you. The terrible things that will happen if competition ever breaks out in the selling of liquor. This prejudice applies to the advertising of liquor on TV. It's the same sort of thing. We just don't do it. We accept beer and wine. Have you ever seen a hard liquor advertisement on TV? This would be dangerous. This would be, and the liquor dealers are very happy about it because it saves them a sizable piece of advertising expenditure. I'm not in favor of advertising liquor. The retail druggists who are so persuaded that there is such a thing as a fair profit, that it makes some sense to say that a $3 profit on a piece of some electrical appliance is unfair, while a $9 profit is fair, they think they know what is meant by fair. When I push them on this, well, what is fair? They say, well, a fair profit on an item is a profit that enables a guy to make a decent return on his capital and have a little left to expand his business. All right, so let's push this a little further. We ask them, what is a decent return on your capital? Well, then they say, 9-10%. But now notice what they're saying. They want to be guaranteed 9-10%. And if you're guaranteed 9-10%, then there's no risk, right? And if there's no risk, there's no reason for 9-10%. Haul it back down to 4.5%. But they don't look at it this way. Now, what happens if we do take it? We all love small business, you know. There's certain things we're all for: the flag, mother, small business. We all support these. Now, we all believe in necessity of protecting, encouraging the small businessman, and so we guarantee every small businessman, let's just say every druggist, is guaranteed a 9% profit. And if we find out that the druggists in the community aren't making 9% profit on their investment, we get the state to boost the prices on some things, or persuade the manufacturers to jack up their minimum resale prices so that every little druggist can make 9%. What's going to happen? I'll tell you what's going to happen. Whenever you guarantee a 9% return from entering into a certain business, you're going to have all kinds of people flocking into that business. Have you ever wondered why there are so many drugstores in towns? Almost every little town you go into is over-drugstored. Have you ever wondered why drugstores are no longer drugstores? Why they sell everything from mops through sweatshirts? You know why? Because the guaranteed the price fixing leads to guaranteed profits, leads to too many drugstores, leads to not enough business for any one drugstore to be able to make a decent profit. It leads to idle capacity. The big store standing there, salespeople standing around twiddling their thumbs, and what do? When you've got a big store, not enough people coming in, your merchandise isn't moving, the thing to do is put in more merchandise. And so the drugstore has become the general store. In the desperate attempt to persuade more people to come through. And the druggist, instead of fighting to get more customers by cutting his prices, he fights to get more customers by multiplying the number of products that he sells. So that it finally doesn't work. I drew a little diagram here. This is a sort of typical situation. On this axis, we're representing dollars, prices, and average costs. See back there? And on this axis, we represent the quantity of whatever the product is that's being sold. Let's just suppose it's drugs, because these are priced very non-competitively. Now, every drugstore has some fixed costs. You know, costs that are going to go on whether they operate or not. The mortgage payments have to be met. Taxes have to be paid, whether they're running or not. Now, these costs are fixed. Certain personnel, probably, their salaries have to be paid whether you sell a prescription or not. But then in addition, as you operate, as you sell, you incur variable costs, the costs that vary with the level of output or level of sales. Well, if you average these out with these fixed costs plus the variable costs, your average total cost curve is going to look like this. It will be a rectangular hyperbola of sorts with respect to some line down. Now, suppose that a given drugstore has an average total cost curve looking like this. Notice that this reflects the fact that the bigger your volume, the lower your costs, the lower your average cost. Suppose the demand for the products of this drugstore looks like this. Now, suppose we also include in average total cost a decent return on investment, because that's kind of a cost. It really is. If a firm doesn't make a decent return on its investment, it'll soon go out of business because it can't cover its costs. A normal profit, if you want to call it that, some return on capital, is a part of doing part of the cost of doing business. Well, this firm could break even. We could do well enough to stay in business, known as at two different prices. You could either set its price up here and break even, or set its price way down here and break even. Now, if it sets its price way down here, the consumer is going to get the advantage of lower prices. He's going to have far more of a product. And, of course, the resources of the economy will be much more efficiently used. But if the price is set way up here, notice we've still got the same capacity drugstore, but look how much less business, look how much higher a price the consumer is having to pay. And this represents waste, tremendous waste. And where does it come from? Well, it comes from, frequently, the notion on the part of businessmen that there is such a thing as a fair profit, which requires government aid in promoting fair prices. What's fair about that? I don't see anything particularly fair about trying to give druggists, put druggists on the gravy train. What's fair about that? Why should a druggist be guaranteed a profit? I mean, if you want to be guaranteed a profit, thing to do is take a steady job, you know, work for somebody else. This is the safest way nowadays to be guaranteed a return.
But if you want to go into business and you want to play the game the way it's played, you're not supposed to be guaranteed anything. Well, let me shift to something else. One of my favorite examples is rent controls, because I go round and round on some of my friends with this. In New York City, they have a system of rent controls. It's not applicable to all apartment units or rental units in New York City, but applicable to many of them. Last year, in June, I was with a friend. We were standing up on the rooftop of some of these old tenements on the Lower East Side, looking out over these horrible conditions. We had just been in the apartment that these two kids lived in, and a crummy apartment. The bathroom is in the bathtub is in the kitchen. And to make turn the bathroom into a kitchen, what you do is take a metal board, metal top sort of, you put it over the bathtub, then it's the kitchen table. You walk up five flights, and the stairs are all, they're concrete stairs, but they're worn and they're rickety, and the floors just go like this, and there are rats in the building and all of that. As we stood up there and thinking about the way these people have to live, he said, well, at least we can be grateful for rent controls. I said, why? He says, well, at least that forces the landlord to charge a fair rent. All right, what is a fair rent? For the apartment I have described, about what do you think a fair rent would be? Well, let me make a suggestion. As much as the landlord can get. How's that? Nope. You shake your head. Why not? What's that would be unfair, right? Why? All right. Well, let's follow this out and see what happens. Suppose we hold the rents at 35. Now, further, we have to suppose that people would be willing to pay more. Otherwise, rent controls make no sense, do they? If the landlord, say the landlord set the price at $100 a month and nobody took the apartment, he'd come down, wouldn't he? I mean, to get as much as you can doesn't mean to set a sky-high price. It means to set a price which is what you can get, the most you can get. Suppose he could get $50 a month, but the rent control pushes that down to 35. And you say, that's fair. That's all that crummy apartment is worth, 35. But somebody is willing to pay 50. What's going to happen?
There's going to be competition.
There's going to be competition to see who can...
Because there's one place that's charging 50, and perhaps someplace else is going to be charging 45, for example, it may have a slightly different inconvenience than there's going to be a leveling off of
price. Well, there's not going to be this leveling off because the price controls have pushed the one down, the rent control.
There's going to be no price.
No, we've got the rent control now. We're holding it down to her fair level. This particular batch of apartments, $35 is the maximum that the rent authorities will allow. That's it. Now, what is going to happen here?
The landlord is going to do as little as possible in the line of repair and maintenance. He's going to rent it on a take it or leave it basis, because if you don't want it, somebody else does.
Right. You're not going to get heat. You're not going to get decent janitorial services. You're going to be kicked around all the time. And What option does a tenant have? He can finally say, he can sack the landlord, he can refuse to pay the rent, but as soon as he does that, the landlord can throw him out. And then what the landlord does, as soon as he throws him out, he paints one wall for $2 and goes to the rent authorities and says, I have redecorated, I want to raise the rent. Now, are they gonna let him do it? Well, they have to come around and investigate. Can you imagine how many investigators it takes in New York City? So what happens? The New York can't afford to pay this. It's too expensive. So they let him do it. So here's a way of getting around. You just hope that the tenant gives you a little brief and then you boot him out. Or you hope that he doesn't pay his rent. That's the thing. Give him such rotten service that he can't stand it. And his only retaliation is to refuse to pay his rent and then you kick him out and then you get your rent out. Now what's happened? There's an awful lot of inconvenience for an awful lot of people there. Now, another thing. Some people will say, well, what you got to do is you set the rent control, the price, the rent control, and you also set the quality terms. But now you try to spell out all the quality terms. You ever seen a lease which tries to spell these things out pages and pages and pages, which when it's all through, it's still very vague, very ambiguous. You simply can't do it. A landlord-tenant relationship has to be built largely on good faith. The landlord cannot possibly protect himself from all the things that the tenant can do to him that the lease can't begin to cover. Nor can the tenant protect himself finally from what the landlord can do to him. And where does this good faith come from? It comes from the fact that the tenant is getting something from the landlord that he wants and knows he's giving something to the landlord that the landlord wants and vice versa. And so both sides are scratching each other's back. Whenever this relationship gets out of whack, when one party is clearly getting the better end of the deal, this relationship of good faith disappears. And then you get these kinds of messy situations where another friend of mine in New York City lives in a very fancy apartment under rent control. He's got a sign, not he, but another fellow in the apartment has a sign in the window. Last time I was there, it said, 24 days without having our refrigerator fixed. Would you pay your rent? And here they're feuding away. This guy that isn't paying his rent, the landlord isn't fixing the refrigerator. Abominable kind of situation to live in. Yeah.
Before the is greater than the supply, then you can give rise to instances where the landlord hints that a little extra on the side or under the table might procure an apartment for him to make up what he thinks the difference between what he thinks he ought to get and what rent control would.
Yeah, all right. This raises the whole area of ways to circumvent the rent control. If you've got an apartment where the legal ceiling is $35, but it's really worth $50, that's an open invitation to graft. Somebody's got to assign you to that apartment. Now, who can it be? It might be the manager. Or the guy who, the kind of, the building engineer, fancy name for the janitor when he fires the furnace. Sometimes, though, even worse, it's the person now living there. Thus, in New York City, there are all kinds of very nice apartments lived in, by the way, by fairly well-off people, which are under rent control. And these are plums. Move into a nice apartment, beautiful three-room apartment, new, all that, for $55 a month, right down by New York University. That's a real good deal. So, well, how do you get into one of those? Find somebody who's in one who's moving out. And what he will do is let you take over his apartment. You pay a key fee. Now, what's happening here is that if you've got a piece of property that's worth, let's say in this case, the market value, if you let the supply and demand take over, that apartment would be worth, let's say, $40 a month more than you're paying. That means that the person who gets that apartment is getting $40 a month, really. He is. He's getting something worth $100 to $60. So he's getting a gift of $40. $40 a month times 12 months in the year comes to about $4,800. $480. $480 a year gift. Let me ask you the question. What would you be willing to pay for a gift of $480 a year? What would that be worth to you? Well, the simple problem in finance, an annual income of $480 a year. You can capitalize that by the interest rate. Let's suppose the interest rate is 4%. Capitalize an income of $480 at 4%, and you come to it's worth $1,200. And so you wind up paying about $1,000 key fee to get into this apartment. Some kind of bribe is what it is. You pay $1,000 for the privilege of taking title to this income stream of almost $500 a year. Now, what are the consequences of that? The most important consequence is that the individual who takes the apartment pays the market price, not your fair price. He's paying part of it in rent and part of it in a key fee. But the part that he pays in a key fee doesn't go to the people who could help alleviate the real problem, which is a housing shortage. If you pay the whole rent to landlords, this will improve the profitability of rental properties and will encourage the construction of more housing units in New York City. And there are only two ways to solve the housing shortage. One, build more housing. Two, get rid of some people, which is the last thing I would want to mention. When you keep rents artificially low, you encourage people to live in an area. Why do so many people live in Manhattan? Some people will say, well, because that's where their jobs are. You don't have to live where your job is. And why do you have a job there? Well, you say, many people have no choice. Right, many people have no choice, but many people do have a choice. You know Norm and Sandy Dietz. They live on Manhattan. They live in a rent-controlled apartment. Why do they live in Manhattan? Would they have to? They would not. They're out of New York City most of the time. Why don't they maintain an apartment in Connecticut? They don't, because they can get one cheaply in New York. Norm and Sandy Dietz are adding to the housing shortage in New York City, and they are adding to it because of rent controls in New York City. I got their permission to say this. So. Well, I mean, what they're doing is perfectly ethical. If the government comes along and imposes a system of fair rents, it is your obligation to take advantage of it. Why not? If you don't, some other guy will. And you're just as worthy as he is. A lot fewer people would live in New York City. Simple argument. You know, the guy who said that you can teach a parent to be an economist by teaching him two words, supply and demand. And it's really that simple when you get down to it. The demand for housing looks something like this, and the supply of housing looks like that. With rent on this axis and number of housing units here, the demand curve for housing slopes this-a-way, and the supply curve of housing slopes that-a-way. And this would be the equilibrium price, the price that would clear the market. But if you impose rent controls and push the price down, you're doing two things. You are encouraging people to move into the area, you're increasing the amount of rental units wanted, and you are discouraging people from supplying rental units. You're decreasing the quantity available. Thus, rent controls create housing shortages. They do not solve them. So maybe $35 a month is a fair rent, but I don't know in what sense it's fair. I don't see that it's fair to the people who are living in New York, or that it's fair to the landlords, or that it does more harm than good.
Thank you for saying fair.
A convert. Well, it depends here on how they are written and how they are administered. You cannot begin to administer an effective building code or housing code in an area like Manhattan when you have rent controls. You just can't begin to do it. Because what you will have to do is close down so many apartment units that you're going to be throwing people onto the streets wholesale, and they won't hold still for it. You know, you come along and tell a guy, look, you are living in a rat-infested building with inadequate sanitary conditions, and we will not allow you to live here. Go out on the street. Well, I think that what we need to do here, really, that there is a very helpful thing we could do to secure better maintenance of rental properties in our large cities. And I don't know of any city where this is not true. Radically alter our system of property taxes. What we do is impose ridiculously low assessments on land and then make up for it with high assessments on improvements. Thus, the building is taxed, the tax rate is the same, but the building is assessed realistically, more or less, and the land is assessed unrealistically. Well, let's reverse it. Let's assess the land at a very high rate and assess the improvements, the property, at a very low rate. We could do this in such a fashion as to get the same amount of revenue. But what would we then be doing? We would be placing a tremendous burden upon the person who refused to fix up his property. Because you see, here, you've got a piece of slum property. It's sitting on a piece of land that is taxed almost nothing, and because the building is dilapidated, the assessor doesn't tax that for anything either. So you don't pay much tax. So, and of course, your tenants don't pay much rent, so you're not getting fabulously rich on it. But now all of a sudden, they come along and raise the assessment on your land. In order to stay in business, you're going to have to get more rent out of your tenants, but you can't do that unless you improve the property. But what happens today is as soon as you improve that property, the assessor comes around and says, wow, what a nice apartment, and your assessment triples. We are deliberately, we're not doing it consciously, but we are deliberately creating slums, maintaining slums in our cities by our ridiculous system of property taxes. There is no single thing that we could do more important, I think, in the fight against slums than to alter our system of property taxes. I'm sounding very much like old Henry George, if you know Henry George. But Henry George was right here. This isn't pure Georgism. I don't believe in the land tax as the only tax. But placing where land is scarce, and that is really what is at a premium in New York City. You try to buy a piece of land, just bare dirt in Manhattan Island. Well, this is what's scarce, the space. Well, let's tax it and force people then to make more effective use of it.
Yeah, and this amendment is very limited to the slum area, even in residential areas. For example, where I live in Minneapolis, in our home, we've made some few minor improvements in the big room, the following year, our taxes went up $50 or $60, and so that this discourages people from keeping up their houses because why improve the houses if they're going to get slumber?
Yeah, that's right.
And so there's not a particular problem of the slum area, but in any area where there is home ownership in any form, and people do, and there's a capital city to get to make trouble. One suggestion that I made was that for the first 5 years after the improvement has been made, that no tax should be paid on it, but after the 5th year, then a tax that should be paid could be assessed on it. So that way, for 1 year, the improvement in the house may enjoy a measure of the effort that he put into of his investment.
Yeah. Well, the whole property tax system is ridiculous, and the only reason we hang on to it is because local communities have become dependent on property tax. The state has preempted the sales tax, and the federal government preempted the income tax, and where's the local community going to get its tax money? The property tax. I hope for the day when we become more realistic about the income tax and begin deriving revenues for all branches of government from the income tax. But this runs into tremendous prejudices. Yeah.
What prevents the local governments from making a shift, assessing the land higher and the improvement lower? Is it because the farmer or man of unimproved land can get too large?
Historically, the farmer has been the opponent here, but the farmer now has become politically unimportant in many areas. Of course, he still has a lot of power in the legislature. See, this would often require an act of the legislature, and the rural-dominated legislatures of our country do not allow the cities to do the things which the cities need to do in order to live. The idea back on the farm in Illinois, for example, in southern Illinois, exports its problems to Chicago, and then from down in Springfield, Illinois, refuses to let Chicago do the things that Chicago must do to solve its problem. And when Chicago protests that they need more home rule, they say, how can you have home rule? Look at all the problems you got, which we sent you. Oh, don't hit Ev. Ev's a good man. No. Yeah, I know. I happen to be very fond of Ev. Ev's a real career. Well, let's talk about that sometime, you and I. I think Ev is a sneaky boy. I think he's one of the greatest statesmen in Congress. An old windbag. Who knows he's a windbag and loves it. Well, somebody else had a... Okay. What I'm trying to just demonstrate this morning, and it would be possible to multiply examples, is that it is difficult to see how we can seriously maintain that businessmen ought to be fair and just when we don't know what we mean by fair and just. Now, she thought that she knew for a minute that $35 a month was fair, and this is typical. We do. You know, we look at something and we say, oh, that's overpriced. That's not fair. But who's to say? I mean, what's a fair price for this chair? That's right. It depends on how badly you want it. It depends on how badly the owner wants it. In other words, what price you have to pay to get him to give it up, and how badly you want it, what you're willing to pay to get him to give it up. And isn't it true that one of the most effective devices for securing fair prices is having lots of suppliers and lots of demanders? What makes the supermarket charge a fair price? You could say, I mean, I can conceive of people arguing this way. Food is a necessity. You cannot do without food. Therefore, we must control the price of food. Otherwise, people who sell food would take advantage of the urgent necessity, the gnawing hunger pangs of the people in the community, and exploit them. Why doesn't this happen? Why, when you go into the supermarket, do you pay a tiny markup over cost? Why is it that supermarkets, that people today buy groceries in a phenomenally efficient and low markup distribution system? Because of competition. A&P, Kroger, Safeway, Jewel, National Tea, Piggly Wiggly, and all the rest of these, they are not setting fair prices. They are pricing to maximize their profits. But because there is so much competition, you cannot charge a very high price and maximize your profits. It is competition which is forcing you to keep the price down. And is there anything better? Is there anything better around to rely on? Now, you may say, well, competition, you know, it doesn't always work sometimes. And that's all true. But what will you put in its place? Before you suspend competition, be sure you got something else to rely on. And I haven't got the foggiest idea what that might be. I listened to Charles Sly, a real gung-ho, freewheeling free enterpriser. He's a real consistent one, too. He doesn't believe in protective tariffs or minimum price fixing or anything. Former head of the National Association of Manufacturers. I listened to him talk one day, and he defined fair prices and fair profits. And I liked his definition. He said, a fair profit is as much as a businessman can get by charging a fair price. And by a fair price, I mean the highest price he can set. That works. Now, of course, Charles Sly came up through the furniture business, highly competitive. And that isn't going to work if we don't have competition. But if we have competition, and we probably have far more of it than we think. Well, we'll come back to this at the end of the week. We probably have far more competition than we think. It may just be, then, that under a competitive economic system, the best way to achieve fair prices, fair profits, fair wages, fair this, fair that, is to let everybody do what he wants to do. Do I sound like an unreconstructed 19th century reactionary? Seems to me that this follows from the knowledge of history, a little common sense, and just some familiarity with the way in which our economic system works. John, you had something.
Just a moment ago, about Kroger and others. I think that's tremendous when they have that kind of competition.
Well, yeah.
But even here, there are devices, many devices, to escape the high cost of packaging. I'm always amazed at the number of housewives, for example, who will buy frozen foods. People with freezers now, who will go out and buy all kinds of little packs of, you know, these little bird's eye or whatever you have, packs of frozen peas, beans. How many of you who have a freezer, some freezing apartment, stock up on these little packages of frozen vegetables? Don't you ever buy the bags? Let me recommend the bags. Compare the price. When you buy those little packages, you are paying a fantastic premium for packaging, for having it in the right size, which incidentally is often the wrong size. That's the irritating thing about it. Buy the bag. Buy a big bag of frozen beans and just stick them in the freezer and then pour out as many as you want. Much cheaper, much cheaper. But people, either because they're not thinking, I don't know what it is, they're creatures of habit, I suppose, or they like the attractiveness of the package. We tend to buy things on the basis of the packaging. Well, as long as people are going to be this silly, distributors are going to take advantage of them. Now, I don't know what we can do about it. This truth in packaging bill, I think, is a nice step. I'm in favor of anything that gets more information out to consumers. Trouble is, I don't think it's going to be very effective. There's a sucker born every minute. There's simply too many devices to deceive people. I don't know what good is done, for example, by saying that you can't call olives large, jumbo, mammoth, and gigantic. You know, that's the teeny little olive is the large one. The modest size is the jumbo, and so on. Oh, phooey. You know, one of the justices, I forget who, I think it was Justice Brandeis, but I may be wrong about that, said that a certain amount of puffing is part of the American tradition, the Yankee peddler tradition. And we take this for granted. We don't believe all this stuff. I think most housewives are learning to be pretty shrewd about packaging. It's true, you can't, you know, people say 1 pound, 7 ounces for 39 cents. And look over here, and this one says 17 ounces, and how many ounces in a pound, you know. I just don't believe that's really that much of a problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's because there's a tremendous markup on the little packages, and they're trying to move them. People are beginning to catch on, and little packages now aren't moving as well as they used to. But here's an example. It used to be all you could get was the little packages. Then frozen foods caught on. People said, maybe we can capture a bigger share of this market by cutting the price. But how can we cut the price? Because of the tremendous expense of putting them in these little packages. We'll put them in big bags. And see, the consumer benefits from this. We're sliding down that average total cost curve. More frozen vegetables at lower prices. Yeah.
Well, another way of introducing this question, I was wondering how I could get it in. About the sales tax. And now you're pushing.
No. Well, I don't want to get into tax evaluation this morning.
And don't forget property tax.
Well, sales tax is more equitable than a property tax. It has less allocative effects. It doesn't. A property tax causes resources to be used in all sorts of wrong ways. Much more than the sales tax does. The trouble with expanding the sales tax is that there's a practical limit to what you can. There are too many ways to, it's a cumbersome tax. There are too many ways to avoid it if it gets up at too high a level. 4 or 5% is probably the maximum sales tax that could be imposed. You get above this, the cost of evasion is so low relative to the advantage of evasion that the tax is going to start being evaded.
So probably we're about, many states, we're about at the limit on sales taxes right now. And that means we've got to go back to the income tax, which horrifies many people. It's 9:30, I'm going to have to quit, but that clock is slow. I want to just make the point, if you haven't noticed, I've been suggesting that if you want to know what fair and just means, it makes a great deal of sense to ask an economist, not a theologian. The answers I've been giving you are economists' answers. I haven't introduced moral categories at all. I haven't said anything about what is due to the tenant, and what the landlord as an individual is deserves in divine justice or anything. And this is what I'm going to come back to and hammer away at tomorrow. That when we pose ethical problems, we run to the pastor too quickly. We ought to be running to the economist and the lawyer and the technical expert. Most ethical questions are pseudo-ethical questions. They do not really involve questions of justice or fairness, but they are questions of what works. Most so-called ethical questions are really questions of what works, questions of means toward ends, not questions of ends at all. We'll see. I don't know what you're up. If you got any more ethical dilemmas, let me have them for you.